When Penrod regained consciousness, he was uncertain where he was and what had happened to him. Close by where he lay, he heard a woman moaning and groaning in labour. Why does not the stupid bitch hold her mouth and have her brat elsewhere, he wondered. She should show some respect for my aching head. It must have been cheap liquor I drank last night. Then suddenly the pain ripped through the roof of his skull, and he realised that the groans were issuing from his own dried-out mouth. He forced his eyes open against the pain and saw that he was lying on a mud floor in an evil-smelling room. He tried to raise his hand to touch his damaged head, but his arm would not respond. Instead, a new shaft of agony tore through his shoulder. He tried to use the other hand for the job, but there was a clink, and he found that his wrists were fastened together with chains. He rolled over painfully and cautiously onto his good side. Good is a relative term, he thought groggily. Every muscle and sinew of his body throbbed with agony. Somehow he pushed himself into a sitting position. He had to wait a moment for the blinding agony in his head caused by the movement to clear. Then he was able to assess his situation. The chains on his wrists and ankles were slaving irons, the ubiquitous utensils of the trade across the country. His leg shackles were anchored to an iron stake driven into the middle of the dirt floor. The chain was short enough to prevent him reaching either the door or the single high window. The cell reeked of excrement and vomit, of which traces were scattered around him in a circle at the limit of the chain. He heard a soft rustle nearby and looked down. A large grey rat was feeding on the few rounds of durra bread that had been left on the filthy floor at his side. He flicked the chain at it, and it fled, squeaking. Next to the bread was an earthenware pitcher, which made him realise how thirsty he was. He tried to swallow, but there was no saliva in his mouth, and his throat was parched. He reached for the pitcher, which was gratifyingly heavy. Before he drank, he sniffed the contents suspiciously. He decided it was filled with river water, and he could smell the wood smoke from the fire over which it had boiled. He drank, and then drank again. "I think I might yet survive," he decided wryly, and blinked back the pain in his head. He heard more movement and glanced up at the window. Someone was watching him through the bars, but the head disappeared immediately. He drank again and felt a little better. The door to the cell opened behind him and two men stepped in. They wore jibbas and turbans, and their swords were unsheathed.
"Who are you?" Penrod demanded. "Who is your master?"
"You will ask no questions," said one. "You will say nothing until ordered to do so." Another man followed them. He was older and grey-bearded, and he carried all the accoutrement of a traditional Eastern doctor.
"Peace be upon you. May you please Allah," Penrod greeted him.
The doctor shook his head curtly and made no reply. He set aside his bag and came to stand over him. He palpated the large swelling on Penrod's head, obviously feeling for any fracture. He seemed satisfied and moved on. Almost at once he noticed that Penrod was favouring his left side. He took hold of the elbow and tried to lift the arm. The pain was excruciating. Penrod managed to prevent himself crying out. He did not want to give the two interested guards that satisfaction. But his features contorted and sweat broke out across his forehead. The Arab doctor lowered the arm and ran a hand over his biceps. When he pressed hard fingers into the site of the broken bone, Penrod gasped despite his resolution. The doctor nodded. He cut away the sleeve of Penrod's galabia and strapped the shoulder with linen bandages. Then he folded and tied a sling to support the arm. The relief from pain was immediate.
"The blessing of Allah and his prophet be upon you," Penrod said, and the doctor smiled briefly.
From a small alabaster flask he poured a dark, treacly liquid into a horn cup and gave it to Penrod. He drank it, and the taste was gall-bitter. Without having spoken a word, the doctor repacked his bag and left. He returned the next day, and the 4 days that followed. On each visit the guards refilled the water pitcher and left a bowl of food, scraps of bread and sun-dried fish. During these visits neither the guards nor the doctor spoke. They did not acknowledge Penrod's greetings and blessings. The bitter potions that the doctor gave him sedated Penrod, and reduced the pain and swelling in his head and shoulder. After he had completed his examination on the fifth day, the doctor looked pleased. He readjusted the sling, but when Penrod asked for another dose of the medicine, he shook his head emphatically. When he left the cell, Penrod heard him speaking in a low voice to the guards. He could not catch the words. By the following morning, the effects of the drug had worn off, and his mind was clear and sharp. The arm was tender only when he tried to lift it. He tested himself for any concussion he might have suffered from the head blow, closing first one eye, then the other, while he focused on the bars of the window. There was no distortion or any double vision. Then he began to exercise the injured arm, starting first by simply clenching his fist and bending the elbow. Gradually, he was able to raise the elbow to the horizontal. The visits from the taciturn doctor ceased. He took this as a favourable sign. Only his guards made brief visits to leave water and a little food. This left him with much time to consider his predicament. He examined the locks on his shackles. They were crude but functional. The mechanism had been developed and refined over the centuries. Without a key or a pick, he wasted no more time upon them. Next, he turned his mind to deducing where he was. Through the lopsided window, he could see only a tiny section of open sky. He was forced to draw his conclusions from the sounds and smells. He knew he was still in Omdurman. Not only could he smell the stink of the uncollected rubbish and the dung heaps, but in the evenings he caught a softer, sweeter whiff of the waters of the river, and could even hear the faint calls of the dhow captains as they tacked and altered sail. 5 times a day he heard the wailing cries of the muezzin, calling the faithful to prayer from the half-built tower of the new mosque. "Hasten to your own good! Hasten to prayer! Allah is great! There is no God but Allah!" From these clues he pinpointed his position with a certain precision. He was about 300 yards from the mosque, and half that distance from the river bank. He was due east of the execution ground, and therefore approximately the same distance from the Mahdi's palace and harem. He could judge the direction of the prevailing wind from the occasional small high cloud that sailed past the window. When it was blowing, the stench of rotting corpses from the execution ground was strong. This gave him a rough sense of triangulation. With a sinking sensation in his gut, he decided that he must be in the compound of the Beja tribesmen beside the Bayt el-Mal, the stronghold of his old enemy, Osman Atalan. Next, he had to consider how this had happened. His first thought was that Yaqub had betrayed him. He wrestled with this theory for days, but could not persuade himself to accept it. "I have trusted my life too many times to that squint-eyed rascal to doubt him now," he thought. "If Yaqub has sold me to the dervish, there is no God." He used the shackle of his chain to scratch a crude calendar in the mud floor. With it he was able to keep track of the days. He had counted 52 days before they came to fetch him. The two guards unlocked the chains from the iron stake. They left his legs and arms shackled. There was sufficient slack in his chain to enable him to shuffle along, but not to run. They led him out into a small courtyard and through another door, into a larger enclosure, around whose walls were seated 100 or more Beja warriors. Their spears and lances rested against the wall behind them, and their sheathed swords were laid across their laps. They studied Penrod with avid interest. He recognized some of their faces from previous encounters. Then his eyes jumped to the familiar figure seated alone on a raised platform against the far wall. Even among this assembly of fighting men, Osman Atalan was the focus of attention. The guards urged him forward, and with the chains hampering him, he shambled across the courtyard. When he stood before Osman, a guard snarled in his ear, "Down! Down on your knees, infidel! Show respect to the emir of the Beja!" Penrod drew himself to attention. "Osman Atalan knows better than to order me to my knees," he said softly, and held the emir's eyes coolly. "Down!" repeated the guard, and drove the hilt of his spear into Penrod's kidney with such force that his legs collapsed under him and he fell in a heap of limbs and chains. With a supreme effort, he kept his head up and his eyes locked on Osman's. "Head down," said the guard,
and lifted the shaft of the spear to club him again. "Enough," said Osman, and the guard stepped back. "Welcome to my home, Abadan Riji." He touched his lips and then his heart. "From our first encounter on the field of El Obeid, I knew there was a bond between us that could not easily be sundered." "Only the death of one of us can do that," Penrod agreed. "Should I settle that immediately?" Osman mused aloud and nodded at the man who sat immediately below his dais. "What think you, Al-Nur?" Al-Nur gave full consideration to the question before he replied. "Mighty Lord, it would be prudent to scotch the cobra before he stings you again." "Will you do this favour for me?" Osman asked, and with one movement Al-Nur rose to his feet and stood over the kneeling prisoner with the blade of his sword poised over Penrod's neck. "It needs but the movement of your little finger, great Atalan, and I shall prune his godless head like a rotten fruit." Osman watched Penrod's face for any sign of fear, but his gaze never wavered. "How say you, Abadan Riji? Shall we end it here?" Penrod tried to shrug, but his injured shoulder curtailed the gesture. "I care not, Emir of the Bajra. All men owe God a life. If it is not now, then it will be later." He smiled easily. "But have done with this childish game. We both know well that an Emir of the Bajra could never let his blood enemy die in chains without a sword in his hand." Osman laughed with genuine delight. "We were minted from the same metal, you and I." He motioned to Al-Nur to go back to his seat. "First we must find a more suitable name for you than Abadan Riji. I shall call you Abd, for slave you now are." "Perhaps not for much longer," Penrod suggested. "Perhaps," Osman agreed. "We shall see. But until that time, you are Abd, my foot slave. You will sit at my feet, and you will run beside my horse when I ride abroad. Do you not wish to know who brought you to this low station? Shall I give you the name of your betrayer?" For a moment Penrod was too startled to think of a reply, and could only nod stiffly. Osman called to the men guarding the gate to the courtyard, "Bring in the informer to collect the reward he was promised." They stood aside, and a familiar figure sidled through the gate to stand gazing about him nervously. Then Wad Hagma recognized Osman Atalan. He threw himself upon the ground and crawled towards him, chanting his praises and protesting his allegiance, devotion, and loyalty. It took him a while to traverse the yard, for he stopped every few yards to beat his forehead painfully on the earth. The Agajirs guffawed and called encouragement to him. "Let not your great belly drag in the dust. Have faith, your long pilgrimage is almost ended." At last Wad Hagma reached the foot of the dais and prostrated himself full length with arms and legs splayed out flat against the dusty ground like a starfish. "You have rendered me a great service," said Osman. "My heart overflows with joy at these words, mighty Emir. I rejoice that I have been able to deliver your enemy to you." "How much was the fee on which we agreed?" "Exalted Lord, you were liberal enough to mention a price of 500 Maria Theresa dollars." "You have earned it." Osman tossed down a purse so heavy it raised a small cloud of dust as it struck the ground. Wad Hagma hugged it to his chest and grinned like an idiot. "All praise to you, invincible Emir. May Allah always smile upon you." He stood up, head bowed in deep respect. "May I be dismissed from your presence? Like the sun, your glory dazzles my eyes." "Nay, you must not leave us so soon," Osman's tone changed. "I wish to know what emotions you felt when you placed slaver's chains upon a brave warrior. Tell me, my fat little hosteler, how does the sly and treacherous baboon feel when it leads the great elephant bull into the pitfall?" An expression of alarm crossed Wad Hagma's face. "This is no elephant, mighty Emir," he gestured at Penrod. "This is a rabid dog. This is a cowardly infidel. This is a vessel of such ungodly shape that it deserves to be shattered." "In God's name, Wad Hagma, I see that you are an orator and a poet. I ask only one more service of you. Kill this rabid dog for me. Shatter this misshapen pot so that the world of Islam will be a better place. Wad Hagma stared at him with utter consternation. Al-Nur, give the courageous tavern keeper your sword.
Al-Nur placed the broadsword in Wad Hagma's hand, and he looked hesitantly at Penrod. Carefully, he placed the bag of Maria Theresa dollars on the ground and straightened. He took a step forward, and Penrod came to his feet. Wad Hagma jumped back.
"Come now, he is chained, and the bone in his arm is broken," said Osman. "The rabid dog has no teeth. He is harmless. Kill him."
Wad Hagma looked around the courtyard as if for release, and the Agajiers called to him,
"Do you hear the emir's words, or are you deaf? Do you understand his orders, or are you dull-witted? Come, brave talker, let us see brave deeds to match your words. Kill the infidel dog."
Wad Hagma lowered the sword and looked at the ground. Then suddenly and unexpectedly, in the hope that he had lulled his victim, he let out a blood-chilling shriek and rushed straight at Penrod with the sword held high in both hands. Penrod stood unmoving as Wad Hagma slashed double-handed at his head. At the last moment he lifted his hand and caught the descending blade on his chain. Such was the shock as it hit the steel links that Wad Hagma's untrained hands and arms were numbed to the elbows. His grip opened involuntarily, and the sword spun from his hands. He backed away, rubbing his wrists.
"In God's holy name!" Osman applauded him. "What a fierce stroke! We have misjudged you. You are at heart a warrior. Now pick up the sword and try again. Mighty Emir, great and noble Atalan, have mercy on me. I shall return the reward."
He picked up the bag of coins and ran to replace it at Osman's feet.
"There! It is yours. Please let me go. O mighty and compassionate Lord, have mercy upon me."
"Pick up the sword and carry out my orders," said Osman, and there was more menace in his tone than if he had shouted.
"Obey the Emir Atalan," chanted the Agajiers.
Wad Hagma whirled round and faced back to where the sword lay. He stooped to pick it up, but as his hand closed on the hilt, Penrod stepped on the blade. Wad Hagma tugged at it ineffectually.
"Get off," he whined. "Let me go. I meant nobody any harm."
Then he dropped his shoulder and lunged at Penrod with all his weight, trying to push him backwards off the sword. Penrod swung the loop of chain. It whipped across the side of Wad Hagma's jaw. He howled and sprang backwards, clutching the injury. With the loop of chain swinging threateningly, Penrod followed him. He turned and scuttled across the yard towards the doorway, but when he reached it, a pair of Agajiers blocked his way with crossed swords. Wad Hagma gave up and turned back to face Penrod as he stalked after him, swinging the loop of chain.
"No!"
Wad Hagma's voice was blurred and the side of his face distorted. The chain had broken his jaw.
"I meant you no harm. I needed the money. I have wives and many children."
He tried to avoid Penrod by circling along the wall, but the seated Agajiers pricked him forward with the points of their swords and roared with laughter when he hopped like a rabbit at the sting. Suddenly he darted away again back to where the sword lay. As he reached it and stooped to seize the hilt, Penrod stepped up behind him and dropped the loop of chain over his head. With a quick twist of his wrists he settled the links snugly under Wad Hagma's chin and round his throat. As Wad Hagma's fingertips touched the sword hilt, Penrod applied pressure on the chain and pulled him up until he was dancing on tiptoe, pawing at the chain with both hands, mewing like a kitten.
"Pray," Penrod whispered to him. "Pray to Allah for forgiveness. This is your last chance before you stand before him."
He twisted the chain slowly and closed off Wad Hagma's windpipe so that he could neither whimper nor whine.
"Farewell, Wad Hagma. Take comfort from the knowledge that for you nothing matters any longer. You are no longer of this world."
The watching Agajiers drummed their sword blades on their leather shields in a mounting crescendo. Wad Hagma's dance became more agitated. His toes no longer touched the ground. He kicked at the air. His damaged face swelled and turned dark puce. Then there was a sharp crack, like the breaking of a dry twig.
All the Agajiers shouted together as Wad Hugma's limbs stiffened. His entire body sagged, and he hung from the chain around his throat. Penrod lowered him to the ground and walked back towards Osman Atalan. The Agajiers were in uproar, shouting and laughing, some mimicking Wad Hugma's death throes. Even Osman was smiling with amusement. Penrod reached the spot where the sword lay, swept it up in a single movement, and rushed straight at Osman. The long blade pointed at the emir's heart. Another shout went up from every man in the yard, this time of wild surmise and alarm. Penrod had 20 paces to cover to reach the dais, and the courtyard exploded into movement. A dozen of the Agajiers nearest to the dais leapt forward. Their swords were already unsheathed, and they had only to come on guard to present glittering palisade of steel to prevent Penrod carrying his charge home. Al-Nur darted forward, not to oppose Penrod head-on, but cutting in behind him. He seized the dragging leg chain and hauled back on it, whipping Penrod's feet from under him. As he hit the ground, the waiting Agajiers rushed forward. "No!" shouted Osman. "Do not kill him! Hold him fast, but do not kill him!" Al-Nur released his grip on the leg shackles and grabbed the loop of the chain that held Penrod's wrists. He jerked this viciously against the half-healed shoulder. Penrod gritted his teeth to prevent himself crying out, but the sword fell from his hands. Al-Nur snatched it away. "In God's glorious name," Osman Atalan laughed. "Ha! You give me great entertainment, Abd. I know now that you can fight, but tomorrow I shall see how well you can run. By evening, I doubt you will have the stomach for more of your games. Within a week, you will be pleading for me to kill you." Then Osman Atalan looked down from the dais at Al-Nur. "You I can always trust. You are always ready to serve. You are my right hand. Take my Abd to his cell, but have him ready at dawn. We are going out to hunt the gazelle.